Hello, it's Wednesday, the 27th of August, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. Former Prime Minister Han Duck-soo is awaiting a court decision on whether he will be placed under pre-trial detention over allegations tied to the December 3rd martial law decree. We'll have the latest details in news briefing shortly. Then for Issue in Focus, we'll examine the latest amendments to commercial and labour laws pushed through by the Democratic Party and the concerns they're raising in the business community. And coming up for Korea Book Club, we'll be reviewing Chinatown by Oh Jung-hee, recently republished as part of the Penguin Modern Classic series. We have all that and more on today's Korea 24. The Seoul Central District Court is deliberating on a pre-trial detention warrant request for former Prime Minister Han Duck-soo. The warrant hearing ended after 3.5 hours, and Han is now awaiting the court's decision at the Seoul Detention Centre. To give us the latest on the hearing, as well as some of our other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang.
Once again, I would like to apologize to you and our listeners for my raspy voice today. It seems I can't shake off this sore throat, so I would like to humbly ask for everyone's understanding once again. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, can you give us the details of today's events involving the former Prime Minister?
Well, Han arrived at the Seoul Central District Court Wednesday afternoon for the hearing, but stayed mum on reporters' questions about the charges against him. The special counsel team handling the martial law case filed for the warrant on Sunday, accusing Han of aiding and abetting the leader of an insurrection, giving false testimony, drawing up a false official document, damaging an official document, and violating the Act on the Management of Presidential Archives. The team, led by Special Counsel Chun-seok, told reporters that it handed in the court a 362-page written opinion expounding on the necessity to detain Han on Monday, and a 160-page visual presentation on Wednesday. The hearing ended at 4:55 p.m. and Han was whisked off to the Seoul Detention Center to await the court's decision. And once again, Han did not reply to reporters' questions.
And what can you tell us about the charges facing the former Prime Minister?
Well, Han allegedly abetted Yoon's actions by failing to prevent him from illegally declaring martial law, recommending a cabinet session just before Yoon issued his decree to make it appear legitimate, and rewriting the proclamation to address legal flaws in the original before discarding the rewrite. Han is also suspected of perjuring himself when he told the Constitutional Court and the National Assembly that he was unaware of the document in question, as he reversed his testimony while under questioning last week and told the special counsel team he had received it from Yoon.
Let's move on. President Lee Jae-myung wrapped up his 3-day trip to the U.S. with a tour of a shipyard in Philadelphia to highlight South Korea's commitment to the revival of the U.S. shipbuilding industry. What do we know?
Well, the Hanwha Philly Shipyard rolled out the State of Maine, the first vessel completed since the acquisition by South Korea's Hanwha Group last year, and President Lee was on hand for its christening ceremony. Lee's tour of the shipyard comes a day after his summit with U.S. President Donald Trump at the White House, during which the two leaders agreed to expand their cooperation across various sectors, including shipbuilding. He attended a christening ceremony for the State of Maine, a national security multi-mission vessel built for the U.S. Maritime Administration, saying South Korea's shipbuilding industry is now taking on a new challenge with the aim of strengthening U.S. maritime security and reviving America's shipbuilding industry. Lee said that through the MASGA project, short for Make American Shipbuilding Great Again, South Korea and the U.S. will achieve a win-win outcome that will see the shipbuilding industries of both nations spring forward together. President Lee and First Lady Kim Hye-young boarded a flight back to Seoul on Tuesday night local time following their 3-day trip to the U.S., and the plane is scheduled to land early on Thursday.
And Hanwha Group simultaneously announced that it will invest an additional $5 billion into its shipyard to expand its US unit. What did the business giant say?
Well, in a celebratory address at the ceremony, Hanwha Vice Chairman Kim Dong-kwon said the investment plan marks the start of a cooperation between the two countries under the Masgar project. The main source of the investment is the $150 billion earmarked by the South Korean government for the shipbuilding sector as part of a pledge to back U.S. projects. Moreover, its affiliate Hanwha Shipping ordered 10 medium-sized oil tankers and one LNG carrier to be produced at the very shipyard.
Meanwhile, North Korea has slammed South Korea's President Lee for his remarks made during the U.S. trip, where he pledged to cooperate with Washington for the peace and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So what did the regime take issue with?
Well, the North's Korean Central News Agency issued the criticism on Wednesday in a commentary, reiterating that the North will never abandon its nuclear weapons, which it described as a source of prestige and honor. The KCNA said it will not be helpful to anyone if Lee holds on to what it called a daydream and an absurd hope about denuclearization, denouncing South Korea as having given up its sovereignty to the U.S. The state-run mouthpiece took issue with Lee's speech at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies on Monday. The report accused Lee of pretending to want to restore relations with the North and showing his true colors as a confrontation maniac by mentioning denuclearization. The report then defended the North's choice to possess nuclear weapons, saying it is inevitable to deter threats from its enemies and adapt to changes in global security dynamics. Pyongyang's official media did not reference Lee's summit with Trump or their hopes for a meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
Let's turn our attention back home. In South Korea, the number of babies born in June has risen for the 12th consecutive month to post a record growth. Can you give us the figures?
Well, according to Statistics Korea on Wednesday, 19,953 babies were born in June, posting an on-year jump of 9.4%, the highest growth since the agency began collecting relevant data in 1981. And as you know, South Korea has long held the spot with the lowest birth rate among OECD nations. Now, there seems to be a light at the end of the tunnel. The total fertility rate, the average number of children born to a woman over her lifetime, rose to 0.76, up 0.06 from the same month last year. The cumulative number of babies born in the first 6 months of this year stood at 126,001 babies, marking a 7.4% on-year spike, also posting the highest increase on record. For the second quarter, the total fertility rate increased by 0.05 on-year to 0.76, with 60,979 babies born, up 7.3% from a year earlier. The state agency attributed the increase to more people getting married, with many of them between the ages of 30 and 34.
Turning towards the National Assembly next, the main opposition People Power Party's new leadership conducted its first official event on Wednesday, paying its respects at the Seoul National Cemetery. Can you give us more details?
Well, party leader Chang Dong-hyuk, who was elected to his post on Tuesday, wrote in the guest book at the National Cemetery that he will move forward to defend freedom and prosperity in his country, telling reporters his party will reach out to the people, listen to their voices, and reflect their concerns in practice. Meanwhile, the opposition party criticized the Lee Jae-myung administration for placing an excessive burden on the domestic economy by pledging exorbitant investments in the United States during President Lee's summit with U.S. President Donald Trump. The ruling Democratic Party, for its part, praised the Lee administration for getting off on the right foot with the Trump administration. The ruling side also said the president made progress on the North Korean a nuclear issue by encouraging Trump to lead efforts to improve ties with Pyongyang and achieve peace on the Korean Peninsula.
And finally, some news from the South Pole. Scientists at the Korea Polar Research Institute have identified microbes preserved in Antarctic glaciers for up to 2,000 years that may pose risks to human health. What do they say?
Well, the Institute disclosed on Wednesday that analysis of ice cores from the Styx Glacier near South Korea's Changbogo Station uncovered 656 strains of microorganisms, including 55 classified as potentially pathogenic. Some carry genes that enable them to evade immune responses, while others contained genetic sequences linked to lethal effects in animals. Notably, certain strains exhibited hemolytic activity, which destroys red blood cells at normal human body temperature. Institute President Shin Yong-chul warned that melting glaciers caused by climate change could release long-trapped microbes, raising the risk of human exposure. The findings were published last month in the Journal of Environmental Research.
And that's where we wrap up our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
The National Assembly on Monday passed another amendment to the Commercial Act, with the ruling Democratic Party pushing it through despite strong resistance from the People Power Party. The PPP launched a filibuster in a bid to block the bill, but the ruling bloc, backed by smaller opposition parties, overrode the effort after 24 hours, prompting the PPP to boycott the vote. The revision aimed at strengthening protections for minority shareholders comes on the heels of another amendment to the Act in July that expanded corporate directors' fiduciary duties to shareholders. It also follows Sunday's passage of the contentious Yellow Envelope Bill aimed at bolstering labour rights. Taken together, this flurry of legislation has stirred unease in the business community, with critics warning the measures could constrain corporate activity and threaten management rights. To get some expert analysis on these issues for Issue in Focus today, we're joined by two guests. First, in the studio, we have our regular contributor, reporter Shin Kyu-suk from the news agency AFP. Mr. Shin, hello, it's good to see you.
Thank you.
And on the line, we have with us Choi Sang-mi, Professor of Business Administration at Ewha Women's University here in Seoul. Professor Choi, hello, and thank you for joining us as well.
Hello, thank you.
So, Mr. Shim, let us first talk about the Commercial Act. For our listeners, could you give us the details about the recent revisions to the Act and what they aim to do?
Yeah, so the second revision of this Commercial Act, which passed this week, it's regarded as a major step in reshaping corporate governance, building on, you know, the July amendment, as you mentioned, which expands the director's fiduciary duties so they must act in the interests of shareholders as well as the company. This new bill imposes concrete rules designed to strengthen minority shareholder rights, with the most significant change being the mandatory introduction of cumulative voting in large listed companies with assets over 2 trillion won, I'm sorry. This allows so shareholders to concentrate all their votes on a single candidate, so it makes it easier for minority groups to elect directors. So in addition, companies are now required to separately elect at least two members of the audit committee who will be chosen through the same process as regular directors. So these provisions are aimed at essentially reducing the dominance of controlling families or large major shareholders and creating more checks on management decisions. So, and supporters frame it as a sort of stronger Second Amendment precisely because it goes beyond symbolic duties to impose structural reforms that could shift power dynamics within the boardrooms.
Right, so it's aimed at making companies treat all shareholders more fairly and give small investors better protection. But what are the points of contention then? PPP jointly passed the first amendment in July, but why are they now opposed to the latest bill to amend the Act that passed the National Assembly on August 25th?
Yes, so, you know, the PPP, as you mentioned, you know, went as far as to stage a filibuster that lasted, you know, 24 hours before their final boycott. So their central argument is that the amendment opens the door to activist investors or speculative capital, particularly foreign funds, because this has happened in previous instances in Korea, who could use these cumulative voting system to push through their own board nominees and disrupt stable management. So, you know, the PPP describes the bill as an economic coup, essentially warning that it undermines corporate sovereignty and may create instability at a time when global competition is already fierce. So, and they criticized the ruling parties for pushing the measure with little consensus, seeing it as a politically motivated move to weaken business autonomy rather than a genuine attempt to improve governance. So, you know, for the PPP, it's less about protecting small shareholders and more about exposing Korean companies to external pressure that could hurt their long-term competitiveness.
Right, and how has the business community responded? What are their concerns?
It's similar, but the leading business associations, you know, not surprisingly, reacted with clear alarm. So 8 major business groups issued a joint statement expressing deep regret over the passage, warning that the changes dramatically increase litigation risks and could discourage bold management decisions. So, you know, so basically hemming the company to gridlock. Their primary concern is that cumulative voting and restructured audit committee will make firms vulnerable to shareholder lawsuits or activist campaigns, as the PPP warned, which could paralyze corporate strategy. In essence, they argue that there's no legal safeguards to protect executives from excessive liability, meaning the managers might shy away from taking, you know, risk-taking innovation or overseas expansion. And, you know, some associations went further, saying the country urgently needs legal tools to defend management from predatory hedge funds and to clarify what constitutes legitimate business judgment, you know, from their perspective, rather than strengthen corporate accountability. The revisions may tilt the balance from weakening competitiveness and adding uncertainty to companies already grappling with supply chain pressures.
Right, so let me turn to you now, Professor Che, and your reaction to the amendments. What are your thoughts on the business communities as well? Concerns as well.
All right. We have to look at both sides, positive and negative. Let me start with the positive side first. The commercial act amendments are, as you know, designed to protect the minority shareholders and to raise overall transparency of the Korean market. By the lowering the threshold of shareholder lawsuit and strengthening the duties of directors, the law signals to investors that Korea is serious about fair corporate governance. This is important because for many years, our companies have suffered from so-called Korea discount, where stock valuations are lower than those of global peers due to weak governance and limited shareholder rights. So in the sense, the reform can be a step toward reducing the discount and attracting more long-term stable investment. But the new commercial act amendment give minority shareholders much stronger rights. For example, it is now easier for them to bring lawsuits against the directors, and the scope of directors' responsibility has been also expanded. This means that even normal business decision could be challenges in court if shareholders believe that decision harm the company. Now, from the company's point of view, the concerns are also real, because lowering the barriers of shareholder lawsuit means that management decision, even ordinary judgment, may face more legal challenges. This can lead to higher legal costs, distract executives, and create a climate of caution where leaders avoid bold strategy. In addition, activists or speculative investors could use these new rights very aggressively, not for the company's long-term health, but, you know, to push for quick profits. This could cause instability in broad rooms and boardrooms and more frequent battles over control. So from a company's point of view, this raises the risk of frequent lawsuit and very heavy legal costs. So it may also encourage aggressive hedge fund or activist investors to pressure companies for short-term gains. In the case, managers may become too cautious so that, you know, they try to avoid board investment or long-term project. In other words, the risk is not only legal, but also strategic, because executive could hesitate to make a decision that involved risk. If you look at the longer term, the impact on our economy depends on how the law is implemented. If safeguards are put in the place to prevent abuse, like early dismissal of a weak lawsuit, then the reform can build trust and attract quality investors. But if litigation risk, spirals out of control, then companies could become defensive and invest less in innovation and even consider shifting some activities, abroad. So the law has the potential to strengthen our capital market, but only if we manage the risk wisely.
Right, so with those concerns then, what's your take on the argument that these amendments will worsen overall business conditions for the nation and thus trigger a corporate exodus?
Yeah, again, let me start with a positive vision first. Stronger shareholder rights are not unique to Korea. They are part of global best practice. So countries that introduce similar reforms often saw increased trust from foreign investors, more stable inflows of capital and healthier financial market. In that sense, this amendment could help modernize our market and reduce the gap between Korea and other advanced economies. But it is true that in the short run, business conditions will become more challenging. The companies may face more lawsuits and directors may feel more personal risk, and management could be more easily challenged by minority shareholder. This risk can slow down decision-making and make an executive less willing to take a bold step, such as a manager, such as a mergers and large investors or R&D project. Now, will this cause a corporate exodus? A mass departure is unlikely, I think, because Korea remains an attractive place for business. So moving headquarters or core corporate operation overseas is very costly and complicated. So Korea still has a strong infrastructure and a skilled workforce and deep global supply chain links. So most companies will not rush to leave. However, the amendment will certainly make a business condition tougher. First, because of the lower threshold for shareholder lawsuit, companies may spend much more time and money on legal defense. Second, the management rights are now easier to challenge, which could lead to more power struggle inside the company. Third, if directors face higher personal risk, they may avoid board investment project, mergers, or innovations. This can hurt competitiveness in the long run. So while I do not expect a massive exodus, I do see a real danger. So companies may become more defensive, invest less, and look for safer environments abroad. So key question is whether Korea can balance protection for shareholders with the stability for management. If not, there is a genuine risk of losing dynamism and even seeing some firms move part of their operation overseas.
Okay, so then is there anything that the government can do to allay the concerns of the business community or minimize the side effects of these amendments?
Yes, there are several steps. First, government should provide clear guidelines on how the new rules will work. For example, what counts as a valid shareholder lawsuit, and how courts should handle weak claims. If the rules are very clear, there will be fewer unnecessary disputes. Second, the governments can set up all these screening systems in the courts so that frivolous or speculative lawsuits are dismissed quickly. So this prevents abuse by short-term investors. Third, for smaller and mid-sized companies, the government could give a pausing period and provide a training for directors so they can adjust without chaos. Fourth, the government should consider alternative dispute resolution mechanism like mediation before cases go to full court battles. This will save time and money for both shareholders and companies. And finally, reforms should be balanced with pro-growth policies, for example, tax incentives for R&D or digital transformation. If companies feel that reforms come together with a new opportunity, they are less likely to feel trapped by any risk.
Well, Professor Che, thank you for your analysis. Now, coming back to you, Mr. Shim, changes to the Commercial Act were not the only contentious pieces of legislation that were passed in recent days. The passage of these amendment bills came after the National Assembly passed the contentious Yellow Envelope Bill on Sunday as well, aimed at bolstering labour rights, with the DP leading its approval despite, again, another filibuster and vote boycott by the BPP. Can you briefly walk us through the gist of this bill as well?
Sure. It's the Yellow Envelope Bill. Is just, you simply said it's an overhaul of the labor law framework. At its core, it broadens the definition of employer so that the responsibility of workers is not limited to subcontracting firms or intermediaries, but extends to parent companies or principal contractors that actually control working conditions. So it also expands what counts as a legitimate labor dispute, now including management decisions such as restructuring or outsourcing that directly affect employment. But more controversially, the law restricts employers' abilities to demand damages from unions or workers over strikes or collective actions, except in very limited circumstances. So companies cannot pursue lawsuits if the intent is clearly to undermine a union's existence. So for organized labor, this is seen as a victory that's levels the playing field for regular or subcontracted workers who are left without meaningful recourse. But business groups warn that bill may encourage more strikes and increase costs for companies.
Professor Chair, what are your thoughts on the Yellow Envelope Bill and its potential impact in areas of concern?
The Yellow Envelope Bill is mainly about the labor rights. In the past, when workers went on strike, companies could file huge damage lawsuits against the union or even individual workers. Sometimes amount itself was so large that it scared the workers away from exercising their right to strike. But the new law limits those damage claims. So it also expands responsibility for the main contracting company, the so-called client company. This means that even subcontracted or indirectly employed workers can bargain with the real decision maker at the top of the chain. For workers, this is an important protection, very important protection. But for companies, it creates a new risk. Let me explain. First, since the threat of large lawsuit is gone, strikes could become more frequent or longer. This means a higher production risk and supply chain disruption. Second, the client company may now be responsible for labor disputes at the subcontractors, even when they do not control daily operations. That means companies may face costs and risks that are very difficult to manage. Third, for global investors, the image of more frequent strikes and unpredictable labor costs can make Korea look like a less stable investment destination. So in short, While the bill strengthens labor rights, it can also raise business uncertainty. So to balance these, the governments must make sure there are fast mediation systems and clear rules on employer responsibility so that disputes do not automatically escalate into strikes. Without such guardrails, companies may see higher costs, lower competitiveness, and even consider shifting operation abroad to avoid those risks.
Well, then also, finally, in the meantime, Mr. Shim, the PPP, their opposition hasn't stopped. They've actually warned of legal action now. Can you give us more details about that, and how do you think that situation will pan out?
Yeah, I mean, the immediate answer is that the confrontation is far from over. I think the PPP has declared that it will challenge the constitutionality of both the Commercial Act revisions and the Yellow Envelope Bill, arguing they were pushed through unilaterally by the ruling party with only token consultation. So this could go to the Constitutional Court. The PPP frames this as a legal overreach that ignores the voices of business and risks long-term harm to the economy. But legal appeals are now likely, and in the meantime, the opposition is pledged to use every tool available to resist implementation. The Democratic Party, on the other hand, shows no signs of retreat. In fact, it's already preparing a potential third round of the Commercial Act revisions, including measures such as mandating the cancellation of Treasury shares to further limit management entrenchment. So that leaves the National Assembly, of course, locked in a cycle of confrontation. And I think, given the bills touch on corporate governance and labor rights, the conflict is set to spill beyond Parliament and possibly into the courts. And in short, the bills do not resolve the debate, then I think it could be signal a beginning of a more drawn-out battle about the rules of the game in Korean business and labor relations.
Right, so despite the passing of the bills, it seems the battle isn't over among the rival parties. We will see how that develops. In the meantime, we will wrap it up there. We've been speaking to reporter Shim Kyu-suk from AFP and Professor Choi Sang-mi from the Ewha Women's University. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index gained 7.80 points, or 0.25% Wednesday, to close at 3,187.16. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, adding 0.06 points, or 0.01%, to close at 801.72. You can check for Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up is Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the most viewed stories and issues on Korean news outlets outside of our news briefing headlines. And to bring us those stories, we have with us Daniel Che, a KBS World Radio News Editor. Daniel, hello, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Jung-ho.
So what do you have for us first?
An iconic figure in Korean archery was found dead Wednesday. He was only 55 and still very much involved in the sport he dedicated his life to.
Yes, so the figure we're talking about is Park Sung-soo, a former national team archer and coach. It does seem like it was due to natural causes, but what do we know about what happened?
According to police, the Gaeyang District archery team coach was found dead in a lodging facility in Cheongju reserved for participants of a national competition at the collegiate level at around 9 a.m. A team member went looking for the late coach and he could not be reached, so he found him in his room, then called the police. Investigators concluded there were no signs of forced entry or assault. Investigations are ongoing, but for now it is believed that Park died of health ailments.
Right, so it appears to have been sudden and unexpected. He had achieved so much, but could have continued to further contribute to the sport. Looking back at how he lived, can you give us a brief summary of his accomplishments?
Sure thing. He was the undisputed top star and ace of the Korean men's archery national team during the 1980s all the way through the 90s. He peaked from an early age, donning the taeguk patch to compete in the 88 Seoul Olympics when he was still a high schooler. No jitters whatsoever, displaying nerves of steel. Park spearheaded the charge and won individual silver and gold in team event. He started the second phase of his archery career as a coach in the year 2000 for Team Kaeyang District and was selected to lead the national team in 2004. Highlights of his coaching career include the Olympic golden runs in both the 2012 London Games and the 2024 Paris Games.
Yes, an incredibly sad loss for Korean sports. Our thoughts go out to his friends and family. Moving on, starting in the new semester next year, elementary, middle and high schools will ban the use of smartphones during class. This is in accordance with a new bill passed in Parliament. Can you tell us more?
Yes, it is. A bill banning the use of mobile phones and smart devices during class hours in school was passed in convincing fashion in Parliament. 115 out of 163 members present voting in favor of the move. The law comes into effect from the next school year, which is March 2026. The law also gives teachers the power to stop students from using their phones on school premises and ask schools to educate students about proper use of smart devices. Not a surprising move, as there are already many schools that practice some form or degree of such prohibition during class. This is seen as a positive step forward in efforts to curb smartphone addiction. More and more research point to harmful effects of such a condition. The bill does allow students with disabilities or special educational needs to use assistive devices. Usage is permitted also for educational purposes or during emergencies.
Yes, while many will understand the decision to implement such a ban, there are voices of concern and opposition as well, right?
Certainly. While some teachers report how adversely smartphone use during class disrupts lessons and how some students are unable to control their emotions when they're asked to give up their phones or even responding in anger, swearing in physical violence. Other teachers say the law violates students' rights to access their smartphone when students are pushed into hyper-competitive environment with no place to meet friends outside of cram schools except through messaging apps or social media. Just confiscating and banning usage, with the main driving force being concerns that smartphone use can affect students' academic performance and takes away time from studying, does raise questions. There should be other more effective measures to address the root cause of addictions. There must be more done than just confiscating smartphones.
Well, in the meantime, we will see how the implementation of this ban goes next year. Turning to the sporting realm, it's official. The Korean men's national football team will play host once again to perennial World Cup favourites Brazil for a friendly.
Yes, the Korea Football Association announced the home team will face the Brazilian squad for a friendly at 8 p.m. on October 10th at Seoul World Cup Stadium, followed by a friendly with Paraguay on October 14th. And this marks Brazil's first friendly in Korea since their last visit in 2022. Among some of the younger Korean stars donning the Taeguk patch, it will be quite an eye-opener if they're facing the Samba squad for the first time.
Yes, while Korean football has evolved over the years, there's still much, I'm guessing, we can learn from Brazil's continued Joga Bonito style, as they say.
Yes, it is rooted in Brazilian soccer culture, emphasizing skill, creativity, flair, expressing joy to playing with passion, elegance and love for the game. Some critics might say that Brazil has lost a bit of its traditional luster or flair over the years, but still, it is one of the top five teams in the world, already booked a spot in the upcoming World Cup with a strong qualifying campaign in South America. In contrast, Korea, 23rd in FIFA rankings, historically struggled against the South American powerhouse, just one win in eight meetings, and that one win was a 1-0 victory from way back in 1999. Before the October friendlies, the Taeguk Warriors will travel to the United States in September for friendlies against the U.S. national team on September 7th and Mexico on September 10th.
Finally, shifting our attention to the world of cinema, director Park Chan-wook's No Other Choice has been selected as the opener for the Busan International Film Festival.
Yes, organizers must have thought, discussed and reviewed long and hard before deciding there was no other choice. But to have Park's latest work open the edition that marks the festival's 30th anniversary. Based on the mystery novel The Axe by American writer Donald E. Westlake, No Other Choice is a dark thriller about a middle-aged man who sets out to find a new job after being fired from a paper company. Lee Byung-hun, who worked with Park in JSA, one of the most successful earlier works of the legendary director, joins forces and teams up with Park again. This time he plays the lead role and is also the host of this year's opening ceremony. The BIFF organizing committee announced the opening selection as well as the number of invited films this year. There will be 241 of them.
And that is where we're going to wrap it up for our career trending segment. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you so much for having me.
time now for Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or in English translations. And joining us this week, we have with us our literary critic, John A. Riley. He joins us on the line once again. John, hello, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Let's talk about our book this week then. What do you have for us today?
Well, this week, I have a book of short stories called Chinatown, written by Oh Jung-hee. That was originally published as Chung-gu-gin Kori and compiled and translated by Bruce and Ju-chan Fulton.
Right, some of our long-time listeners may remember that we actually covered the title story Chinatown back in 2020 in a previously published edition of the story, but the original Korean dates back all the way to 1979, and there have been several translations that have been published over the years. But in July this year, the story was brought into one of the world's most prestigious literary series, Penguin Modern Classics. And this translation has been published together with a selection of Oh's other stories. So this sheds new light on Oh and her works. So does that also mean that some of our listeners... may well be familiar with Oh, but still, John, for our listeners who might not know her work, could you fill us in?
Yes. Yeah, so Oh Jung-hee's one of 20th century Korea's most significant writers. Lots of contemporary writers like Pyeon Hae-young have acknowledged her influence. And she was born in Seoul back in 1947. Her family had migrated from the north to the south just a few years earlier. And she grew up in the poverty and the disarray of that era, which I think is what inspired the title story of today's collection. And she went on from that to study creative writing at university. She received the Chungang Ilbo Award while she was still studying as an undergraduate. And she's gone on to win many prizes, the Dongin and Isang prizes. She's a master of the short story, but she's also written magic realism and she's written children's fiction in addition to her main work.
Right, so clearly she is a much celebrated writer. How would you describe her main body of work?
Well, certainly the stories in this volume, they don't really emphasize plot or even perhaps character in the conventional sense. They're about a time and a place, and they're filled with all kinds of sensory details. Smell is particularly emphasized in these stories. And you can even see something of the progression of South Korea in the four stories in this book. The first one takes place in that kind of impoverished environment just after World War II and Korean independence, whereas the final story takes place at this middle-class garden party.
Okay, so let's talk about the title story then, Chinatown. It is arguably Oh's most famous work. What can you tell us about it?
Well, I'm not sure how directly autobiographical this story is. We always have to be careful with those things, I think. Mm. But the narrator of this story, she's a 9-year-old girl whose family have just moved from North to South Korea in that post-World War II era. And they're now living in Incheon's Chinatown. And I feel like the details which this story is full of, they must be things that Oh saw or heard about because they're so vivid. The story basically just describes the narrator's impressions of the area and the various incidents that happen as she's growing up.
Right, so it's a sort of coming-of-age story, but in very difficult post-war circumstances. What are some of the themes in this story?
Well, this isn't an easy read. There's quite a lot of cruelty in this story. There's a lot of animal cruelty and there's violence against women, which is reported very matter-of-factly by the narrator. I guess because she's seeing it for the first time as a child, she's kind of just accepting it. This is all in the service of portraying this country that's just been through decades of colonial occupation and all these problems. And there's also a sense of the kind of aimlessness of life at this time. The children do go to school, but when they're not at school, they're just free to kind of roam by the railroad tracks themselves. And then at the center of all this is that coming of age story that you mentioned. The narrator's kind of growing awareness of the world and in particular her own impending adolescence.
Also, John, since the story is called Chinatown, what's the portrayal of that area like in the story?
That's really interesting. Yeah, well, as you know, Incheon's Chinatown today, it's a tourist attraction and it's an area of historical interest. But at the time of this story, it's a working, bustling, low-income area with lots of Chinese immigrants. And O portrays it as quite a dangerous place, especially if you're working there as a prostitute. But what's quite interesting about it is that O portrays the Korean adults as they're either completely indifferent to the Chinese people or they're quite prejudiced against them, whereas the children are completely kind of fascinated by this other culture. But what was really interesting is all the stereotypes they imagine are very similar to how the West viewed Chinese culture at the time. If we think about something like the Fu Manchu books and movies, all those stereotypes are there in the narrator's childhood mind. So, yeah, it really is a time capsule of this time, but also this specific place.
Now, as we said earlier, this is just one of the four stories in this collection. Can you tell us about the others as well? Are they similar to the title story?
I'd say they're relatively similar when you consider the whole breadth of O's writing career. Well, in the next story, which is called Running Man, there's a man who used to be a driver for an army colonel, and the colonel passes away and he receives these keys. He's kind of wondering what to do, and eventually he goes to the colonel's apartment. And when he gets there, he's flooded with these memories, and we learn that there was more than just a professional relationship, more than professional admiration between these two men. And then in the next story, Mermaids, O brings up another important issue of 20th century Korea, adoption. There's a young girl again who wants to know why her mother will never take her directly to the beach. And this eventually leads to the revelation that she's adopted. And then, like I mentioned earlier, the final story is The Garden Party, where our main character feels really out of place at this party, which is being held by a more wealthy, perhaps more cultured doctor. And there's this sense of acute social embarrassment as she feels she doesn't fit in this environment. A bit too much alcohol is consumed, and you can imagine what might happen. So, yeah, all these stories are much shorter than Chinatown. That's the main feature here. But all of them have this distinctive style full of these impressions and these little sensory details.
And taking the four stories together then, what stood out for you? Were there any overall themes that brought them together?
That's a difficult one, but I can certainly say that I was not afraid to portray controversy and violence and often the ugly, the difficult side of life. She also repeatedly returns to the theme of women's role in society and culture at that time. And she's obviously interesting outsiders, I think, because the one story here that focuses on a male protagonist deals with gay themes, which I'm imagining must have been quite controversial at time of writing.
Right, I believe that story was first published in Korean in 1969 under Chuja. So it is pretty remarkable that she was writing something like that in Korea at the time. So overall, what did you make of this collection?
Well, I would say if you want a vivid picture of Korea in the mid-20th century, you should definitely read the title story and read the rest of the stories as well. The closest thing that I've read recently that I can make a comparison with is Yi Chang-dong's stories. I don't know for a fact whether he was directly influenced by her, but lots of contemporary Korean writers are, and you can feel those similarities as you're reading it. And I also think it's really interesting that we're starting to see more translation of those writers who've influenced the current crop of writers. Penguin Modern Classics recently republished a blockbuster fantasy novel by Terry Pratchett, and now we're seeing Korean literature in that same series getting that same kind of potential exposure. So I really hope we get more translations of O's work that are going to show her full breadth and just what she's capable of.
So once again, this is the Penguin Modern Classics edition of Chinatown and Other Stories by Oh Jung-hee, translated by Bruce and Ju-chan Fulton. And that was our pick for Korea Book Club this week. We'll wrap it up there. John, thank you so much for that review, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, bye.
And that wraps up our show. Thank you for staying with us. Do join us again tomorrow for more news, views, and reviews from Korea. Till then, we hope you have a wonderful day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye. Hello, my